You're listening to a podcast of a program produced in 2013 as part of Aloud, a series of dynamic conversations, readings, and performances that take place in the Mark Taper Auditorium at the historic Downtown Central Library in the heart of Los Angeles. These programs are presented by the Library Foundation of Los Angeles, which supports the Los Angeles Public Library. To support Aloud or learn about the entire podcast collection, please visit www.lfla.org/aloud. So tonight we look at how history can be made graphic. How can drawings, the tropes of comics and graphic novels offer new insights into historical events? A World War I battle or China's Boxer Rebellion? And we have on hand two celebrated authors, Joe Sacco and Jean Yuan Yang, who boldly use their graphic talents, in this case, in the service of understanding history. In addition to reporting from the troubled regions like Gaza and Chechnya, Joe Sacco has traveled around Europe with a rock band, designed record covers in Berlin, created a satirical comic magazine, Centrifugal Bumble Puppy, covered the Bosnian war crimes trial in The Hague, and toured the U.S. with R.L. Burnside, one of the elder statesmen of the great living Mississippi bluesman. He's the author of many books, including Palestine, which set new standards for the use of the comic book as a documentary medium, and was the first nonfiction graphic novel to invite serious comparison with Art Spiegelman's Pulitzer Prize-winning Mouse. Sacco was a recipient of the prestigious American Book Award in 1996 for Palestine. Among his many other books are Footnotes in Gaza, an astonishing book that I stayed up late reading last night, and his best-selling collaboration with Chris Hedges, Days of Destruction, Days of Revolt. In his newest book, Sacco turns from reportage to history. It's called The Great War, July 1, 1916, the first day of the Battle of the Somme. A drawing to end all drawings, a book that is also a scroll, which documents one day of the grisly World War I battle that went on for 4 months, took more than a million casualties on both sides, and advanced the Allies less than 10 miles. Jean Yang began drawing comic books in the fifth grade. He was an established figure in the indie comic scene when he published his first book, American Born Chinese, which is now in print in over 10 languages. He won the Prince Award and was a finalist for the National Book Award. His latest book is the gorgeous, innovative graphic novel Boxers and Saints, which is currently a 2013 nominee for the National Book Award, which looks at the Boxer Rebellion, a war that took place on Chinese soil over 100 years ago. Boxers and Saints is a two-volume project. In Saints, the Chinese Christians are the protagonists. In the other, their Boxer enemies are. The books explore themes of identity and self. He asks, what does it mean to be Chinese, to be Christian? Can you be both? Jean is also a great advocate for using comics in education. He currently teaches at Hamline University as part of their MFA in Writing for Children and Young Adults. And in conversation with Jean and Joe tonight is the knowledgeable Charles Hatfield, professor of English at Cal State Northridge, where he teaches comics, media, and cultural studies. He's the editor of the newly released The Superhero Reader, and he is the author of Alternative Comics and Emerging Literature. Please join me in welcoming Joe Sacco, Jean Yang, and Charles Hatfield. Thank you.
Good evening. I brought books. We are here at the library and under the good graces of the Library Foundation of Los Angeles, and we are here with artists of the book. So I brought books. This is Joe Sacco's latest work, The Great War, July 1st, 1916, the first day of the Battle of the Somme. And if you've seen this book, I mean, if you've really seen this book, you've also handled it, right? You've handled it, you've unfolded it, and you've let its panoramic images sort of work their way over you. And then, of course, there's Jean Yang's very new, just released set of graphic novels, or maybe it's one novel with two interlocking ports. I don't know. You can buy the parts separately, although that I can't help but see them together, Boxers and Saints. And I wanted to show you the physical artifacts to start with, partly because I think that these books are fulfilling, but they're also sort of resisting the graphic novel idea, right? No sooner have we arrived with books of comics, with graphic books or graphic novels, than we've seen comics, graphic narratives that don't quite fit with the way that we're ordinarily used to handling books or thinking about books. These are objects, I think, that both fulfill what we expect out of books, but also maybe go further or help us to see books new in a new way. Now, both of these works, Joe's The Great War and Gene's Boxers and Saints, are works about traumatic and decisive and divisive events in history. Both of them concern war. They concern mass violence and the movement of populations, and they concern things I would rather read about than experience, to be frank. But both of them are also unusual in form, right? Joe's is an enormous 24-foot-long panorama, a concertina book or accordion fold book, and Gene's Boxers and Saints is actually two books that seem to have a dialectical relationship with each other, right? So let me start out with just a question about the form and the packaging of these two very different works. I've seen people read Boxers and Saints on the Kindle. I've seen that work digitally. I have a hard time imagining something comparable to that happening, Joe, with your latest book. Let me ask you both, were these formats, these unusual ways of making books, always on your mind from the get-go when you started your projects?
No. Actually, it was someone else's suggestion. Mm-hmm. I had a roommate a long time ago in New York City, and one night we were getting drunk and playing darts. And he said, wouldn't it be great if you drew a long fold-out illustration of the Western Front.
Mm.
I mean, his model was Matteo Pericoli's Manhattan Unfurled, which is a great accordion-style look at the Manhattan skyline. Mm. And I sort of, laughed about it and forgot it. And 15 years later, he just got a job at W.W. Norton, and he called me up and he said, do you want to do it this way? So I have to credit him with the idea. Mm-hmm. And my initial reaction was sort of no. And but then I thought, it could be interesting. I would love to just draw.
Mm.
And I thought of the Bayeux Tapestry,
mm-hmm.
and how you can get a narrative out of that. It didn't have to be static.
Mm.
So that was the genesis of that.
Right. So it came from a conversation long ago, but I guess you didn't really think that conversation was going to lead to anything serious.
Yeah, like right? Hundreds of conversations you had when mm-hmm. someone says, wouldn't it be great if you did this?
Mm-hmm. No.
So this one just, it just resurrected itself.
Mm. Gene?
So Boxers and Saints comes out of an ambivalence that I felt about the Boxer Rebellion. Mm-hmm. I got an idea to do a graphic novel about the Boxer Rebellion. When I started in on the research, I really couldn't decide which side of that war I felt more sympathetic to.
Mm-hmm.
So this was the way I solved it. I did two books, and the protagonists of one book are the antagonists of the other.
Now, you needed that dialectical form between the two books in order to deal with your own mixed feelings about it?
Yeah, people ask me now, who if you had to choose one side, who would you choose? And I still can't. Mm-hmm. I still can't decide.
So was there a point when you thought, I'm going to do a graphic book about the Boxer Rebellion, and you hadn't yet hit upon the idea of doing two books, or was that very early on?
Yeah, in the very beginning, when I first got the idea, I just wanted to find a hero, right? Mm-hmm. And I researched, and I kept debating whether I would go with the Boxers mm-hmm. or with their victims.
Mm-hmm.
And in the end, I really just couldn't decide. Yeah, right. So at the outline stage, when I outlined the books, I outlined them as two different books.
So it's fair to say somewhere between the initial spark of the research and the actual idea of outlining the book is something you really could make. And now, were there parts of what ended up in Boxers that were originally you thought meant for Saints or vice versa? In other words, were there scenes or bits from one book that migrated over to the other as you worked on the project?
No, there are scenes that I thought would be interesting to see from the other side. So I've included those in both. Mm-hmm. But I don't recall a scene moving from one to the other. Leaving one and making its way.
If you've not yet read Boxers and Saints, the Boxers volume deals with the Boxer Rebellion from the point of view of a boxer, a member, a leader in the Society of the Righteous and Harmonious Fist. Bao is his name. He's the protagonist there. He interacts briefly but crucially with a young woman that we come to know in the other book, Saints. She takes the name Viviana, and she is one of the Chinese Christian converts that, in fact, the Boxers are really trying to expel from their land, if not destroy, right? So there is this sort of tug of war between the two perspectives in the books. And there are those few scenes in common that just make it, you know, I think, and in some way that are just absolutely crucial to making it. So early on, you hit upon the idea that you needed to have a twofer
set
of books.
Yeah, and right. I ended up doing is I outlined both books, and then I wrote and drew Boxers first. And as I was drawing Boxers, I wrote Saints. Mm-hmm. So originally, I had actually expected them to come out in two separate seasons, with Boxers first and then Saints second. Mm-hmm. It was my publisher's idea to release them simultaneously and have them in this awesome fancy box that they made. is this your first book in a box? It's kind of crazy,
book in a
right?
Box. Comics are now in boxes. It's like,
yeah.
It's like boxed wine. It's not as bad as it seems.
Now, Joe, to what extent was, beyond note-taking, of course, you did a lot of reference, I gather, and you perhaps can tell us a little bit about the research that went into that. Were you doing a lot of writing for The Great War that ultimately got hidden? Like, is there an underlayer of script writing there, or were you always working in picture? I mean, the panorama is wordless, almost entirely wordless. Although there's front and back matter, where Joe talks about the inspiration for the project and some of the things he was highlighting in the project, is there a lot of writing or a lot of journaling, note taking, or even script writing behind the panorama?
There was note taking for my own benefit. I mean, I've been reading about the First World War since I was about 10, and I have shelves of books about the subject. Mm-hmm. So I was actually rereading certain books, taking notes because there are many things you don't get other than from prose, mm-hmm. a lot of first-person accounts. So I was reading, let's say, Martin Middlebrook's book, First Day on the Somme, and anytime there was some visual idea I got from his prose, I would mm-hmm. note it. But I never intended to have like a script to go with this, mm-hmm. really. I at first didn't even want any kind of introductory piece. I just wanted it to be what it was. Mm. I mean, to me, the interesting thing for me was just drawing for the sake of drawing and cutting out the step of writing. And mm-hmm. I didn't want to, I mean, when you write, you kind of explain, and part of me didn't want to explain. Part of me, most of my work has been journalistic and pretty subjective journalism. And this is, in some ways, I consider it my most objective work, mm-hmm. because I'm not really giving the reader an idea of what I think about the battle. I definitely have my own ideas. When I show General Haig, who was the architect of the battle, I show him in a very neutral sort of way. Mm-hmm. You can look at it, if you know something about him, depending on your viewpoint of him, you can, you know, judge him or not. So, I didn't want explanations. Mm-hmm. In a way. I have some annotations, yeah. just to make it clear mm-hmm. that what certain things that are going on, because I realize mm-hmm. a lot of people aren't familiar with the Battle of the Somme mm-hmm. or much about the First World War, especially in the United States.
There's a very fine-grained level of detail in the panorama, and I wonder to what extent in your own mind you sort of individualized or mentally wrote out or worked out these scenarios. I mean, this is just one blow up from one of the 24 folds or plates that comprise the panorama. Did you have names or notions about any of these people, or were you really trying to deal with them as a mass?
I was trying to deal with them as a mass. But that was the whole point. I wanted a disinterested view of this battle as if you're an alien looking at what humanity is doing on July 1st, 1916, mm-hmm. you know, as people go about their business, which is killing each other. But I wanted it to be sort of from a bit of a distance. But the interesting thing is when you're drawing, I'm not planning it out so much. I mean, I'm drawing a character and I'll think, oh, this guy is, you know, he's getting a piece of bread. This one's taking a piece of bread that he shouldn't. I mean, mm-hmm. I'm just coming up with the little stories for myself as I'm going along. Mm-hmm. It helps to keep it interesting to me. And that spontaneity, I hope, just adds a bit of life to the drawing itself.
Can I ask you a technical question?
Yeah.
How did you do this? At what scale did you draw it? And to what extent, if at all, is digital compositing involved in putting this together? Or did you draw a massive panorama in real space?
Well, I mean, I don't know how to use Photoshop. I'm very bad with technical stuff. So what I did is I drew on a board about a yard long. Mm. And the folds, I call them pages. Mm-hmm. Basically, there are two pages per sheet. Mm-hmm. And then I sent photocopies of how one sheet should overlay on another mm-hmm. to the production people at Norton. And I let them figure out the technicalities. Mm. But my instructions were pretty clear, I think.
I was wondering, the design and manufacture of this particular book must have been a right challenge to all parties involved.
Yeah. I just do the drawing, you know, that's up to them.
Now, did you sketch out that whole panorama before moving into the individual images, or did you actually work it across from left to right, like a reader discovering it as you went? Or?
Well, I sketched out some part of it only because the guy who had suggested it to me needed to sell this idea mm-hmm. to other editors at Norton. So he wanted some rough idea of what would be going on in each page. So I spent a couple of hours basically planning it out. It helped me get a sense of the rhythm, you know, three or four pages or five pages of build-up, a number of pages of soldiers moving into the trenches, some pages for the battle. I got an idea of how long I would stay on each particular scene. But I usually compose directly on the board. I don't do roughs. Mm-hmm. I mean, and that creates a problem. I mean, it's not, it's just that I don't like doing two layers of work.
Wait, that's true for all your stuff?
Yeah.
Wow.
But, but on the other hand, I'm always erasing. I mean, I've got an eraser in one hand and a pencil in the other. So, I mean, it's not a perfect system. It's just one that I'm...
There's no perfect system.
Yeah, there's no perfect system. It's just the one I'm used to.
You said you were trying to be dispassionate or give sort of an alien observer's view, right? And you said that Boxers and Saints was grown out of a very personal kind of ambivalence, like a feeling of division. Process-wise, was Boxers and Saints much different from books that you've done previously, or did you follow much the same
method? No, I think I've always... all of my books are from something that bugs me, something inside of me, something that's important to me. Or I feel like every single one of my books comes out of a little mini obsession that I go through. And I don't really know how to write in another way, I think. I know there are amazing authors out there who are able to write stories that they aren't personally connected to, but I'm not one of those people. Mm.
Now, did this start with as a constellation of words for you, or did this start out as thumbnail drawings? Or, I mean, once you got to the point where you were outlining, as you said, was that a visual process?
I think most of my books come out of voice. Mm-hmm. And I know from talking to some of my cartoonist friends that isn't necessarily the norm for cartoonists. Mm-hmm. But usually I'll hear some dialogue and I'll write it out on a piece of napkin or some scrap paper. And then eventually when I have enough of it, I'll break it into panels and then I'll figure out the layout.
But it sounds like the processes behind your two books are very, very different. Although it also sounds like the process behind The Great War was quite different from your previous books generally.
Yeah. I mean, normally when I'm doing books with words in them, most of my books, I write a full script from start to finish. I don't know if maybe your characters have more chance to develop as you're going along. Maybe they can take twists and turns. I don't know how it is for you. But with me, I mean, because it's nonfiction, I don't want to have some loose end. I don't want to draw and write at the same time because there's always a problem. You're going to have some loose end that you don't know how to resolve now. And comics are very hard to edit.
Yeah.
I mean, once you've started drawing, you know, you don't want to edit anything because it could mean some serious redrawing.
Yeah.
So the script
through the whole book.
Yeah, through the whole book.
Yeah, it's terrible.
Yeah. So the idea is not to... That's why I wanted to have a script, so I know where it's going.
Wait, so what does your script look like? Is it like a full-on script, like all words?
All words. Okay. It's like this guy saying that, and then there's the narration.
Are there panel breakdowns as well at that stage?
No.
Okay, so it's like a movie script.
It's like a movie script, except without any visual clues of what I should be doing.
Okay.
Because if the script is basically set, I will edit it to some extent while I'm drawing, but if it's basically set, I want something to be fresh. That's why I like to draw spontaneously. That's when I'll break down the panels. I'll look at a script and I'll say, okay, today I'll draw this much. It'll fit on this page. And what should I draw? I'll draw this. So at least some storyboarding is another.
So
to
you
me,
never
useless.
Do thumbnails or
no,
anything like that?
No.
Wow.
Because I want something really spontaneous. Because the script is not set in stone, but it, you know, it's like you're going back to a script you wrote 5 years ago. You want something fresh on the board every day. That's how I look
so
at it.
So do you know how many pages your script is going to be?
No, I just start going.
You just kind of go.
Yeah.
Okay.
Is this a way of keeping it, of keeping some bit of spontaneity in the late phases of the process?
It's got to be enjoyable and it's got to be fun. On some, the drawings I do aren't often fun, but they have to be sort of interesting, let's say that.
At the time
I'm doing it. It's a very tactile thing. And writing is difficult. I never know how long it's going to take. It might take 6 weeks or 6 months to do a script, but drawing, I know. It's like ditch digging. I always sort of know approximately how far I can get.
So it sounds like, you know, this book notwithstanding, which is different, but generally you have a lot of planning and scripting you have to do, and then there's something you want to keep a little fresh and spontaneous when you get to that image-making phase.
Right. And this was all kind of spontaneous, you know, basically.
But you don't even do, like, character designs or anything?
Oh. No, I grant you that.
Okay.
But, you know, they're really minimal. And, again, it causes problems. For example, I'll do like, okay, this is the guy from the front, this is the guy from the side, I'm done. And then I'll start drawing, and about 30 pages into it, I'll say, actually, now he sort of looks a lot more as I want him now. Mm-hmm. And then I'll have to go and redraw those faces. So, like I say, it's not a perfect technique.
Okay.
And it doesn't even work well for me, necessarily. But it's just how I like to do things.
Okay. Now, Gene, you said that when you were growing up, you wanted to be an animator. Do you do what animators do? Do you draw model sheets of all the characters?
Yeah, I do model sheets. Okay. I do model sheets. It could because you know I kept having that same experience of your characters will evolve as you draw them, right? And I think that happens to any cartoon character. If you look at Garfield or Bart Simpson,
Mickey Mouse,
they look totally different
as they
go through the paces.
Well, in Boxers and Saints, there are characters who age visibly. So you know, Bao ages in the course of Boxers, and there are also characters like Bao and others who transform. They keep turning into different forms and then back again. So I have to imagine you did a lot of designing of those characters initially so as not to lose your way with how they looked.
Yeah. I actually do thumbnails for the whole book before I start penciling. And I do model sheets for all the major characters as well. And I keep those taped up by my drawing table. But you know, even with the model sheets, it drives me crazy. My characters still change. Right? And I still have to go back and I have to redraw faces.
What's interesting about this is that people knowing your work might assume maybe the opposite of what we've heard, that your stories are overtly fictional. Even when there's a historical grounding, there's an element of magical realism or an element of fantasy. Joe's work based on research and on interviewing, on a face-to-face conversation with many, many subjects, and yet it sounds as if you try to preserve something spontaneous within the image-making process, whereas you try to plan that out much as an animated filmmaker might ahead of time. And it seems almost would have been the opposite
weird.
Of what I would have expected, right? Obviously, people who know your work would know that it's reference-dependent. In some ways, I mean, they would probably assume that because it's based upon primarily with conversations with people in theaters of conflict in places where things are still going on. So it's an interesting difference in process there. I wanted to ask both of you about the sort of ethical responsibility that you take on when you're doing these books that are based either upon recent events or upon documented historical events. Mm. I mean, this is a question that partly addresses the journalistic side of Joe's work, but also there's a fraught historical subject in the Boxer Rebellion. And I have to say, I've been teaching Boxers and Saints quite recently, and I've had a number of students express, shall I call it, confusion, or I don't want to call it dismay, that might be too strong a word, but they've expressed uncertainty about these elements of the fantastic and what my initial description had led them to believe was a historical novel, right? Mm-hmm. So you can see some of this happening here on the screen behind us. So can I ask you both, starting with Eugene, since we have this image up here, about what you feel about the ethics of these undertakings as you're trying to turn history into stories or history into books?
Yeah, I struggled with that a lot. I think when I set out on this project, I knew it was going to be historical fiction. So I knew I was going to make stuff up that I was mm-hmm. going to insert into my historical narrative. But I did struggle with what pieces I was allowed to mess with and what pieces I was not. So for the Boxer Rebellion, nobody really knows how the Boxer Rebellion began. It began among the poor in China. And like a lot of the history of the poor, it was just undocumented. People mm-hmm. didn't start writing about the Boxers until they made their ways into the cities and they began interacting with the Chinese who were in power and also with the Europeans. Mm-hmm. And in that way, I think I felt like I had a lot of freedom, at least in the beginning, to make stuff up. The fantastical elements, I felt like, reflected a reality that was in the historical narrative. So mm-hmm. so the Boxers believed that they could actually perform mm-hmm. this mystical ritual and call the Chinese gods down from the skies. And these Chinese gods would possess their bodies and give them superpowers. You know, so it's kind of like, it's like Shazam. It's basically mm-hmm. like Shazam. It's like Chinese Shazam. That's how I thought of it. So I just felt like, you know, because that was part of history, mm-hmm. that gave me an in to introduce magical realism. Right. But then later, like after they get into the capital city of China and they get into their final conflict with the Europeans, that final conflict is very well documented. Mm-hmm. And there are pieces where I thought the historical record did not fit my dramatic purposes. So I did make those changes. And when I was making those changes, I was thinking I was going to be like Chester Brown and Louis Riel. I was going to set up all these notes about mm-hmm. How I had deviated from history. Mm-hmm. But then when it came time to do those notes, I realized that I'm a terrible researcher and I didn't write down any of my source material. So
Chester Brown's book, Louis Riel, is about one of the founders of the Manitoba province and the great sort of Métis or half-blood revolutionary in Canadian history. And it's a very controversial topic to this day among many Canadians. And he did all sorts of things monkeying with the history, which he dutifully documented in extensive handwritten endnotes at the back saying,
yeah,
this person didn't really do this, but I made them do it anyway.
It's really impressive, though, that he was able to do that.
And it's also impressive that he's so disarmingly blunt about the moves that he's made.
Yeah.
I did do some research into the siege of the Legation Quarter, as uh-huh. it was known, in the capital city, as well as the death of the German dignitary that serves mm-hmm. as the flashpoint. So I understood that those were that you were closely tracking the historical record there. But you told me some things earlier that there were characters in the text that were modeled upon historical personages that I wasn't even
yeah,
aware of.
Yeah, like my two main characters are fictional characters. Mm-hmm. They're not part of the historical record. Mm-hmm. So just right there, it's historical fiction. And then towards the end, there are, like, even with there's this German ambassador that shows up towards mm-hmm. the end, and he gets shot in the head. So he was shot in the head in history, mm-hmm. but he wasn't shot in the head by the same person that I have mm-hmm. in my book.
Yeah. Did you get the idea for the sort of magical, realist, or fantastical elements for the Boxers before you came to the similar elements in Saints?
You know, so in Saints, in Boxers, the supernatural element is the Chinese gods, right? And that was very clear in the books that I read. For Saints, I also wanted a parallel, and I couldn't decide who I wanted to use. So I was looking around for a Chinese saint. Not a Chinese saint. I was looking around for a Catholic saint. And I ended up hitting on... hitting on sounds terrible. I ended up choosing Joan of Arc. Mm-hmm. Okay? And the reason why I chose Joan of Arc is because, you know, as I read more about boxers, I realized that that the boxers and Joan of Arc lived these parallel lives. That Joan of Arc was basically like a French boxer. You know, mm-hmm. so the boxers were these poor... teenagers, mm-hmm. there are these poor teenagers with these mm-hmm. weird spiritual beliefs that compelled them to defend their country, mm-hmm. right? And their country was under siege at the time of their lives. And the same thing was true of Joan of Arc. Joan of Arc was this poor teenager mm-hmm. who was compelled by these strange spiritual beliefs to go and defend her country. Mm-hmm. And both of them, you know, met with these grisly fates at the end. Yeah. So I just thought that I just thought that by introducing Joan of Arc into the narrative, I'd be able to introduce some interesting parallels between European and Chinese stories.
Now, you noted that there were places where the historical record didn't seem to go the way you might have wanted it to go dramatically. Sure. And so did you rein yourself in there, or did you just take the leap into fictional? I mean, this comes back to the question of what you feel ethically charged to do given this topic.
Yeah, I made changes. In other cases, I just left it out. Mm. You know, if it didn't fit, I just left it out. Mm-hmm. But like there are certain cases, like with the German minister, where I made a change. You know, so he was shot by somebody who had not shown up in the story up until then. And I thought narratively, it just didn't make sense to have this one guy come in, shoot this character in the head, and then disappear.
Mm-hmm. Now, Joe, your work is known both for. I would say some historical excavation, as in footnotes in Gaza, right, or in some of the historical context, for example, in Safe Area of Garajda. It's also known for sort of up to the present, in the moment kind of reportage and interviewing. As someone with a journalistic background and someone whose work is often tacking back and forth between the present or near present and the past, do you have thoughts on this about what the ethical burden you undertake when you do this work is?
Well, I approach things journalistically, so to me, I go by journalistic standards as far as quotes mm-hmm. and as far as characters, like no composite characters. Nothing exists in the books that didn't actually happen. Mm-hmm. I do go back into the past, and of course, going back into the past presents certain problems because you're drawing things that you didn't see, mm. And there's sort of often I'm quoting someone, and then I'm drawing what they're describing in the quote, and so the quote is accurate, mm-hmm. but the drawing obviously is my interpretation, and I think there's a sort of a tension between those two mm-hmm. things, which I try to alleviate by being as informed about the past as I can be with my drawings. I try to be accurate about certain things. In certain cases, I'll walk over the ground that people have talked about. In Footnotes in Gaza, a lot of it takes place in a schoolyard. Mm. So that school still exists. So go there, take pictures of the school, have someone walk me through, you know, where were you sitting, mm-hmm. what was going on. Drawing maps for people mm-hmm. so they could show me where things were. Getting sort of, you ask questions that most journalists probably don't need to ask, which are visual questions. Mm-hmm. So I recognize the tension, but as much as I can, I try to bring accuracy to it. Mm-hmm. Knowing, you know, when you're drawing something, you realize you're a filter and you're interpreting. Mm-hmm. So obviously I have to allow for that. Mm. But then, you know, you look at photographs, mm. even photojournalism, and you realize even that's a filter. You know, a photojournalist can take a picture of this, but what's going on over here and over here might also be in tension with what the subject mm-hmm. is. So that's kind of where I stand on the ethical ground.
Do you ever feel like you can use the filter for what you want narratively? Or is it you always try to minimize the filter as much as possible?
I try to minimize the filter okay. as much as possible. Okay. I mean, I do. Mm. I come out of the journalistic mindset. Mm. It's not fiction.
Okay.
With this, on the other hand, mm. with this drawing of the First World War, I also bring a journalistic attitude to it because I'm trying to make things as accurate as possible. Because I think if you do that, if you draw the right equipment and the right weaponry, as anal as that sounds, it adds to the verisimilitude, I think. So that's kind of what I try to accomplish with something like that.
Now, you mentioned, and you do mention it in the sort of the preface to the Great War as well, that you've had military history on your mind for most of your life, right? That's something that's been with you as either background noise or a positive sort of preoccupation and an interest of yours, right? Have you been throughout much of your life one of those military history buffs who tries to get the munitions, the costumes, the, you know, everything just so? Do you take some delight in that, or is it really that you're just trying to deliver a human story?
No,
and you need it to be believable?
I would rather never have to draw an AK-47 as long as I lived. I'm so sick of drawing that weapon. I just did a story about Srebrenica, and I thought, oh no, I have to draw the same old stuff, and I didn't like it. You know, I didn't enjoy that, and I certainly don't enjoy drawing the weapons. I mean, that whole boyhood thing of being interested in it and being fascinated by drawing it has long left me.
Right. I mean, a lot of Joe's, what I think of as earlier work that sort of predates his shall I say, notoriety as a comics journalist, but the comics that you were doing, well, on 20 years ago maybe, already suggest that maybe being a war reporter of sorts was in your future. I'm thinking about like that issue of Yahoo you did called How I Love the War, which is dealing with the coverage of the Persian Gulf War, or the essay that you did about the bombing of civilian populations, or the piece you did based upon your grandmother's testimony.
My mother's. And
your mother's testimony.
You know, I grew up hearing stories of war. I grew up in Australia, so I didn't hear just my parents' stories about Malta, where the family was born, which was very heavily bombed by the Germans and Italians in World War II. But there were many European immigrants in Australia, and often the family friends were other immigrants from other parts of Europe. And the commonality between people of that age was talking about the war. You know, what was it like for you in Holland? What was it like for you in Germany? And so you just heard these stories, and you grew up hearing those stories.
Right. Especially during those years when you were living in Australia as a young boy. Right. Now, a lot of your work deals with what it's like to be a witness to, basically doing what Susan Sontag called regarding the pain of others, right? There's a lot of that goes on, particularly as you show yourself as a journalist working with informants, interpreters, fixers, and that seems like a motif that runs through a lot of your work as you get present-day testimony about past events, right? Did you find the Great War Project sort of a liberation from that in some ways?
I mean, it was sort of a liberation from journalism. I needed a bit of a break also. And I've thought of going in other directions in any case. So that's one of the reasons I accepted the project. I mean, when you're doing journalism, I'm trying to focus on individuals and how they're affected by larger events. At some point, doing the journalistic work, you begin to wonder about humanity in a way. And they're not questions you can answer with journalism. You can think about them more with an artistic approach. And so this gave me a way of thinking about some of those things artistically as opposed to journalistically.
And this is the one book of yours that notably does not include yourself, doesn't kind of contain this sort of drawings of self, yourself as an intermediary as an investigator, and so on. So wait, are you telling us that you went to draw the Great War so that you could have relief?
No, I mean, I want to think about the same things I've been thinking about, perhaps, but from another vantage point. I've focused a lot on individuals in the big picture, and now I'm focusing on humanity as a whole. Because I have questions. It's not that I have answers to all this. I'd like to go a bit further now with some work and think about that. But This was a way of getting me to think of soldiers enthusiastically marching to the front and to draw those. And when you're drawing, as you know, I mean, you're spending a lot of time with these characters and you're thinking about them and you're kind of inhabiting them in some on some level. So you begin to ask questions, you know, I'm a different person now that I am than I was when I was 18. And I think, would I have been very enthusiastic about going to the First World War? You know, I probably would have, knowing who I was at 18. Now, of course, I mean, the idea is...
This is one of the things that we do hear about the First World War in particular, and we hear it about the soldiers on the Somme, many of whom were... You know, it was a volunteer army, and of course, the trauma of kind of... which became not only an individual trauma, but particularly for the British, as they thought about their role in the war, it became a sort of national trauma. The Somme is, you know, on that first day in July of 1916, almost 100 years ago, what there were about ultimately about 20,000 deaths.
20,000 deaths.
Yeah.
Estimated that 10,000 died in the first hour.
Right.
Which is, when if you add all the American servicemen killed in... It wouldn't even, I mean, the amount of American servicemen killed in Iraq and Afghanistan combined, it's less than that.
Yeah, and of course, that's often been taken as kind of a stunning indictment of the military leaders. And it's, I mean, that's been a grieved question since at least since Winston Churchill wrote his account of this, which was published in the late 20s. I mean, a lot of people living through that period view the Somme as their disaster. In some way. You said that most of the sources that you consulted were Anglo-centric. They dealt with a kind of British perspective.
Yeah. I mean, you know, growing up in the Commonwealth and being English-speaking, I just naturally gravitated toward that.
I wanted to ask you, Jean, a question that I was reminded of thinking about the presence of soldiers and colonials in Boxers and Saints. In the book, the Chinese speech is rendered as in American English dialogue, whereas the speech of others, and this includes, I think, the French and the English and others, is rendered in a kind of code. At first, I was going to say a kind of gibberish, but it looks like the code is actually consistent, that you've devised a kind of alphabet of symbols that could be decoded, but you're sort of hiding from the Chinese-speaking characters an understanding of what the French or the British are saying, right? Have I read that right? Yeah, but strange things happen with the voices that the characters speak in as they traverse these cultural boundaries. Can you tell us more about that?
Yeah, well, I wanted the point of view. Well, this was definitely going to be a book that was published by an American publisher for an American audience. And I wanted the point of view to be solidly with the Chinese, with the Boxers in the first volume and with the Chinese Christians in the second. And I thought one of the ways I could do that was by presenting the speech of the foreign missionaries and the foreign soldiers as the Chinese would have experienced it. So as something very foreign. I actually created a font. I created a scribble font where I came up with a little scribble for each of the characters. So if you wanted to, you could actually go and decode all of it. Now, in Boxers, the scribbles are just there. They just sit on their own within the word bubbles of the, of the Europeans. But in Saints, I provide the translation in caption boxes that sit below the panels.
There's a number of things happening like that in Boxers and Saints. There are moments where Bao's father, for example, who's been sort of beaten and broken by his experience, speaks in a sort of gibberish of his own. And then there are moments when characters seem to be reading from or speaking through biblical text where the lettering of what they say looks different from ordinary speech. And I've noticed that when Viviana sees that vision of Christ near the climax of Saints, that Christ speaks in a couple of different ways. Right? That things happen the way he's speaking. We probably shouldn't go minutely into that if you haven't read it yet, but there's so many interesting things happening with the text-image relation along those lines. I wanted to ask you something, Jean, about... Well, okay, these are pages from Saints, right, that we're looking at here for just a moment. And Saints is a story about how Foregirl, is baptized and becomes Viviana. She becomes a Chinese Christian convert. And I was really intrigued, as were a lot of my students, about how alien you make the Christian stories and theology seem at first for Viviana, almost to the point of sacrilegious humor, I think, frankly. I mean, in she refers to Jesus as the acupuncture victim with the needles in his hands, because that's how she perceives him, because the first person to witness to her is in himself an acupuncturist. And then there's this scene where it looks like the mysteries of, you know, the Trinity and the Incarnation and transubstantiation. You know, it's the whole catechism class. She's struggling to understand this. And I wonder about whether you were conscious of kind of treading a line there. She doesn't have the most altruistic of motives for joining the Christian community first, right?
Yeah, sure. I modeled the main character of Saints after a number of people. One of them is a relative of mine. So I have this relative who converted to Catholicism when she was an adult. And she had these childhood experiences that I feel really led her to that. She was born under an unlucky day, according to the traditional Chinese calendar, and she had this little sister that was born under a lucky day. So her grandfather hated her but loved this little sister. And anytime he had treats, the little sister would get them and she would not. And then later as an adult, she converts to Catholicism. So she never connects these things together, right? But to me, it seems like it makes a lot of sense. You know, you were not able to find a place for yourself in the culture that you were born in. So you go and look to the stories of the other. And then in terms of her not having altruistic reasons for joining the faith, I think that's true for a lot of people. You know, I think a lot of us who are who have embraced some sort of a faith tradition as an adult, we did go through a period of time where we were going simply because the church or the synagogue had awesome ski trips. And there was somebody cute in our Bible study, and their cookies were amazing.
Cookies, right?
Yeah, you don't get cookies at home, so you have to go to church for them. So, and then for a lot of us who remain in a faith tradition as adults, at some point there's a deeper spiritual need that gets met. You know, even if the reason why we went in was not for spiritual reasons.
Yeah, I want to ask you a question that you've just brought to mind, and I want to volley that over to Joe as well, and it has to do with your perception of audience. Like Boxers and Saints is a book published by First Second, which publishes comics for readers of all ages, but particularly has a reputation for doing children's and young adult comic books. And Gene's previous work, largely, certainly American-born Chinese, has been received as a comic that can be read and can, frankly, be assigned to or given to young readers as well. And I wonder if there was any sort of, if you can share with us any kind of editorial back and forth, both about the depiction of religion, but also about the depiction of violence and loss in the text, and whether, you know, what sort of decisions you made, whether you made them alone, or whether you had editorial input in terms of deciding how far you were going to go in the depiction of these things.
Well, you know, I'm categorized as young adult. That was not a category that I thought about, you know, when I started doing comics. Because I think in the comic book industry, age demographics are not as big of a deal as in the traditional book market. In the traditional book market, if you go into Barnes & Noble, there are all these tiny little categories, right? And if you go into a regular comic book store, usually most of the stuff just kind of sits in this one area. So I was assigned the young adult category after I signed up with this publisher. But now that that's happened, I feel like I kind of fit. I fit pretty well in there. In terms of the violence, Boxers and Saints is definitely the most violent work that I've done. And a lot of that is just, I felt like I really had to reflect that because that came up in my research over and over again. The images that I came across in books and in these photo archives that I went through were just incredibly violent. I was really shocked. Like sometimes I would get nightmares because they were so violent. And I felt like I had to at least have some of that in my book just to reflect that. In terms of how that fits into the young adult category, I had the privilege of being a judge for the National Book Awards in the Young People's Literature category a few years ago. So for 1 year, I read everything, not everything, I read a lot of what was published in that category. And I realized how flexible that category was, because those books dealt with everything. It was like multiple suicides and parents leaving and dogs dying, everything. Anything you can think of, cancer, anything. Zombies eating your boyfriend. It just felt like there was no tragedy that was too tragic for young adults.
But were there any specific sort of, I don't want to call them editorial skirmishes, but any moments of conversation like, Gene, you want to do this? Do you want to do this?
No, not really. Okay. Yeah, not really.
That's interesting. No. That's encouraging.
Yeah, my editor is kind of awesome, though. Yeah.
Now, Joe, do you carry a sense of audience around with you? And if so, does that vary from book to book? Or
if anything, I think of myself as an audience. I'm interested in these subjects, and I suppose I want other people to be interested. Mm-hmm. But generally, I think of the audience as someone sitting across me from a table. Mm. A lot of journalists cut out their best stories. If you sit around a table with another journalist and they're telling you what happened that day, you know, you're thinking, why isn't that in your article? Well, because it happened to me. I'm involved in this. And that stuff gets cut. Mm-hmm. But I've never felt that. I want to sort of tell the interesting parts. So if my work about Bosnia, if all the young girls who are under siege, all they're talking about is genes, that isn't something to dispense with quickly. That's actually interesting in and of itself. You know, the fact that they're hanging on to that, to me it's a sense of dignity or whatever. But I'll let those stories, I won't stand in the way of those kinds of stories. Also, I think of in terms of the audience as I want to sort of demystify the process of getting a story and the process of... how does a journalist navigate through a situation? I studied journalism, but they still seemed like demigods who knew everything that was going on. But then when I was in the reality of it, I realized, oh boy, they're being led by the nose by a fixer or the translator's not telling them everything. And I just want to show that to the reader.
Now, you've been critical in the past of the kind of journalism that, let's say, dominates television, where there's a sort of a veneer of even-handedness. There's kind of an obligatory nod to the other side or an other side, as opposed to taking a principled position, right? Do you feel that the dispassionate view that you were trying to get in the Great War, that stop short of presenting a particular point of view, I'm coming back to what you said at the start. Do you have a read of these events?
I have a read of the events of the Battle of the Somme, and I have a read of the British High Command, and I have a read of the average soldier and his enthusiasm and his willingness to obey commands. I have a read of all that, but I didn't want that to... I think what happened there, just presented as it is, can reach the reader in any way the reader... Whatever the reader brings into that, I'm going to just leave that. I didn't want to be so particular about putting my own viewpoint. I think it's sort of clear in a way by what I'm showing.
I'm asking you this partly because when American comic books really learned to get serious about war, when Harvey Kurtzman was writing war comics, for example, in the early 50s, these were not exactly anti-war comics, but they had a kind of... They had the qualities of literary naturalism, of showing characters caught up in forces beyond their control, the way a lot of sort of post-Darwinian writers in late 19th century American fiction did, like Stephen Crane, for example, and those war comics of the early 50s, which were the first ones that weren't really gung-ho, that at least acknowledged that war is hell, and they were often written with kind of a tragic irony. They weren't exactly anti-war, though. They kind of presented war as a set of things that you couldn't say no to, or a set of huge events that little people, often the common soldier, were sort of caught up in. And they function, you know, the war functioned the way, let's say, the Arctic wilderness functioned for Jack London, or the way the open ocean functioned in Stephen Crane and his story, The Open Boat, where the characters are helpless. But I was thought in much of your, I hesitate to call them war comics, but in many of the comics that you've done, you don't take that kind of these are vast and incomprehensible forces in which people are caught up. Instead, you present these things as contingent upon human choices. You know, they're contingent, they're possibly avoidable, and there are some parties that are deserving of blame, right? Do you come at the Great War Project with a different kind of perspective?
Yeah, it is a different perspective. It's standing a bit back from, I mean, it shows the British, but it's not just about the British in my own head.
Mm-hmm.
It could be about Americans going into Iraq,
mm-hmm.
on some level. But I'm making it very particular, to that particular scene.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know if that's answering the question at all. Maybe it's not.
Well, I'll come right out and say that I thought you had General Haig, the commander of the British Expeditionary Force, who's on the left-hand side of the panorama, as a figure distanced. I mean, literally, I'm visually distanced from what was going on. And
well,
that felt like an implied critique to
me. Well,
it
was an implied. It's a true critique. I mean, Haig never visited the front line.
Mm.
He had a nice chateau.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, I show him just taking his 4-minute stroll around the yard. Mm-hmm. The great thing about not having words is you can't sort of damn people. If you want to damn people as a caricature, it's just too obvious.
Mm.
So I'm just showing him as, like I said, as if an alien was just watching him walking without any sort of commentary about him, whatever I feel about him.
Yeah. Well, the British experience of World War I was often an experience of class, and a lot of the people that have told that story, whether in books or in movies or in comics, have talked about not just the British experience. I mean, you can see Jacques Tardy do this in his French comics about the First World War as well. That distance between the officer class and what's actually happening.
But the thing, I mean, I would say there's a difference between the high command and the rest, because actually, if you look at the proportion of sort of junior grade officers, they died in greater proportion than the average soldier. I mean, the lieutenants and captains were actually leading from the front. They would be the first over the top and be in front of their troops. And throughout the war, they lost more proportionally than the average soldier.
Mm. Let's open the floor to questions for anyone and everyone who might want to ask Gene or Joe questions. We'll have a circulating mic in order to help you to be heard.
That's an awesome dress.
Yeah, I got it like for tonight. So
awesome.
I was like, I have to have the dress. Yes, I actually had a question for both about color, because I mean, the First World War as it is, we see it in black and white photos, we see it in black and white illustrations already, and then again in no color. So I was just kind of intrigued by that, and also for the use of color, that between Boxers and Saints, Boxers is just amazing with wow, this vibrant color and everything, and then Saints is like bleh. It's like kind of gold tones or Joan of Arc, but then just this gray. What I mean, what would you call it? Like a weird mauve? I mean, it's like a gray tone.
They call it a French gray.
Yeah, they would call it that. So I just had a question about color.
Sure. Mm-hmm. She asked you first.
Oh, well, I don't know how to use color. That's sort of it. I mean, I've leaned on black and white now because that's what I know how to use, and I try to use it to its best effect. But the truth is, I've never really sat down and learned how to use color. Like I said, I don't even know how to use Photoshop, and I should learn it. I don't say that with any sense of pride, but that sort of answers it, I'm afraid.
I like your stuff in black and white. I think it's really effective.
Thank you.
For Boxers and Saints, you know, for Boxers, I wanted that book to be about what it means to be a hero. You know, that book was about heroism. So I wanted to pull from heroic storytelling traditions. I wanted to pull from Chinese opera, and I wanted to pull from American superhero comics, which all use really vibrant colors in their storytelling, right? And that's also why it's much longer than Saints. I wanted that book to be like a heroic epic. So I wanted it to be super long and kind of sad at the end. Then Saints, you know, I was thinking about Saints. I wanted Saints to be about sainthood. And I was thinking about how, you know, regardless of what religious tradition you come from, this idea of sainthood, the idea of holiness, is tied in deeply with the idea of humility. So I wanted Saints to be more humble than Boxers in every way. So it's shorter. I wanted the colors to be much more muted. And I wanted it to read, like I didn't even use rulers. So I used rulers and boxers. I didn't use any rulers and saints. So, and that's why the borders are all kind of wiggly. I even asked my publisher to publish saints on cheaper paper, but they were not into that idea at all. They wouldn't let me do that. I said, I want it to look like cardboard on the outside and then inside like newsprint. And they're like, no. So that's why it ended up. I was trying to carry the theme of humility all the way through that book. Mm-hmm.
So we've already referenced Susan Sontag's On the Pain of Others, and one of the things that she promulgates in that book is that we've lost the empathy or the ability to empathize because we're so used to seeing photographic representation of tragic events. Mm. And I don't know if you're familiar with the painting, but Magritte has a painting, The Science of Knowledge, which is typical absurdist Magritte, but it's a wonderful commentary on how we evolve in ways to kill each other. And I'm wondering if, with comics, we have gotten to the point where we're using non-representational art to bring us back in touch with the experience of what people are going through in these events that have almost become cliche when they're photographed.
Mm. Well, I mean, that's an interesting point. I think what drawing allows you to do is to look. It's a certain filter. I have a very hard time looking at photographs or documentary footage of violence. I mean, if you've ever seen documentary footage of someone in South Africa or something being necklaced, it's, you know, I personally just turn away from it. I almost cannot deal with that. When you're drawing something, it allows, I think, the reader or the viewer to look at something that they couldn't really see, or they would have an extremely difficult time looking at in real life. So it allows you to look. That's how I think of drawing.
It's hard for me to answer questions from people who are smarter than me, but I will say this. I think there might be something to, like, you know, Scott McCloud has this idea that the simplification of cartooning allows the reader to put themselves in the situation a little bit easier. And maybe that dynamic is at play.
There's something spectacular about the depiction of violence in documentary photography or documentary film. I mean, spectacular in the sense that it's distracting, or spectacular in the sense that it grabs you by the lapels and it doesn't let go. I mean, going back to Sontag, she was very critical of the idea that a single photo, no matter how real it might be, would actually do anything other than influence you on the level of sentiment, on the level of your preconceptions, your already decided partisan positions. She said, strictly speaking, to understand requires narration. Comics get that visceral quality, I think, of the image, albeit a hand-drawn image, maybe a more deliberate image, but they also give you narration, they give you sequence, they give you backstory behind those images so that there's the arresting visual appeal, but there's also maybe the heft of narrative, and again, that sense of ethical responsibility we were talking about, right?
I wonder, you know, something that I've been thinking about your work is comics, because everything's drawn, there's this automatic suspension of disbelief. And I think that's why it works so well with things like superhero comics and magical realism. And I think that's why I introduced magical realist elements into my narrative. But I was wondering why your comics work. Because the suspension of disbelief actually should work against what you're doing, but it doesn't. And maybe that's what it is. Maybe the suspension of disbelief is the belief that, like, you suspend your disbelief that you and the other person are, you and these characters are separate. Then I don't know if that made sense.
No, it makes sense. I guess I don't have anything else to add to that, but I appreciate that thought.
Well, there's something that Roland Barthes called the grain, which means actually seeing struggle, seeing evidence of struggle in the artwork, in the stories that you read or the pictures that you look at. And I think that to me adds a really grounds. I mean, take your point. They're drawn images, so our suspension of disbelief might be threatened by that. But because your role as a witness is always drawn into, you know, those journalistic comics that you've done, and we can literally see your handiwork on the page, right? In some ways, that may that may get past our skepticism, mm-hmm. because we're seeing handiwork, and handiwork requires effort, blood, sweat, mm-hmm. tears, right?
Yeah.
So, other questions?
Yeah, I was just interested that each of you all chose to create a project based on events basically a century or more ago. And Joe, you've been fascinated by the First World War for your entire life, your young life. But each of you all are focused on that. And I'm just curious, what is it about those periods, those specific sets of events that so absorb your attention and your imagination, your creative imagination, and what you think they might have in terms of relevancy to now?
Well, I spent a lot of time thinking about me. And as an Asian American, you know, I feel like I'm a combination of Eastern and Western cultures. And the Boxer Rebellion was an embodiment of that. It was the coming together and the clash of East and West. You know, that was the very first time there was a global conflict that involved both Eastern and Western nations. So as soon as I read about it, I just really felt a deep, visceral connection to it. Like I felt like I wanted to learn more about that as a way of learning more about me, which I like to think about.
You know, the reason I was fascinated by the First World War when I was a kid is there were certain reasons. The idea of gas masks, biplanes, all that stuff that is sort of intriguing, somehow attractive and also horrifying, even when you're a kid. Mm. But I think this idea that huge amounts of people separated by 100 yards or a little more than that were battling each other for years at almost no gain of territory. In 1915, I think 5 square miles changed hands on the Western Front, and hundreds of thousands of people are dying. I mean, this is always, it still sort of shocks me. Even when I was drawing the Great War, I'm still shocked. I still have the ability to be shocked by something I've been reading about over and over again. To me, the thing that relates to now is that enthusiasm of the soldiers. World War I was perhaps the one time working classes around Europe who could have been very well organized because they still worked in factories then, maybe could have said no to a war. In fact, as the war progressed, they did say no. The Russians said no. The French army mutinied in 1917. Now I forgot my train of thought. I'm sorry.
And you're talking about the eagerness of the soldiers in relation to today.
Yeah, and I think about this when I think about this in terms of even what happened in Iraq and how it seems like it's going to be a kind of quick, exciting war when none of us are going to be hurt. And there's that point where enthusiasm meets reality, which, I mean, is epitomized on the first day of the Somme, but it even happened to the Americans in Iraq because, okay, we went into Baghdad, the war is won, and now what's going to happen? And what happened was another war. And these things are, I think, are always relevant. And I think each generation needs to learn this. We never learn, it seems, from the past. I mean, that's kind of a cliche, but I think it's true.
That's the image at the end of Eric Bogle's great song. The band played Waltzing Matilda, where you have the patriotic parades, and the singer is the... this is a classic folk song example, disabled veteran, kind of. And the parades keep coming, the parades keep coming. It's a very haunting image. Mm. We had one or two hands over here, I think, for questioning.
Maybe two more questions.
Yeah.
Kind of poignant, being post-Remembrance Day. Joe, can you tell us if you did any research with motion pictures?
Oh, did I use motion pictures as a form of research?
Yeah, it's such as Stanley Kubrick's Path of...
The Paths of Glory is this still on? Yeah. Mm-hmm. Okay, The Paths of Glory is one of the great war films of all time. And I've watched it so many times, I've almost memorized it. But the difference is the Somme battlefield area was not chewed up to a large extent when on the first day of the Somme. It got quickly chewed up, but it was pretty much open ground with fewer shell holes. It didn't have this surreal sort of thing going on, you know. So I didn't draw any surreal images in that sense. Mm-hmm. There was a British propaganda film called Battle of the Somme that came out in 1916 that was shown in theaters in Britain. And I looked at some of those images just to, for accuracy's sake. And then I looked at YouTube videos because they would show, I mean, this sounds really technical, but when you're drawing something, you want to get it right. But like some howitzer firing, and I don't know how far the barrel goes back. I don't know what the artillery people are actually doing. But if you watch those, you get an idea of what everyone's doing on that gun. So I was able to draw those sorts of things. But all those great war cultural images and films, I didn't really watch while I was doing it because I didn't want to be sort of influenced by them.
Another question?
Gene, I hadn't read your work, but I'm very interested in reading your work now to actually experience the filter that you use in the creation of it. The question I have is for Joe. You said earlier that in your process, you first write out a script from beginning to end to make sure you attain the historical accuracy, and that in your drawing, you use your creative. But it kind of seemed to contradict the feeling that you didn't want to put in a filter, that you wanted to minimize the effect of the filter that you provide in telling the story. So that brings me to question. The eraser in one hand, is that done to combat your filter or just fix drawings?
I'd like to think fix drawings. I hope that's the case.
The introduction by Edward Said in Palestine, that's basically what I show people when they want to know what comic journalism is. And so in terms of like visual storytelling, visual journalism, I also always try to say, oh, you should do comics when you're telling your stories. It'd be a great way to do it. But then when I realized that telling stories, especially in journalism, is fucking, it sucks. Excuse me for cussing, because it takes a lot of work. And to imagine that you even draw all these meticulous things, it blows my mind, and it always blows my mind even till today. So I wanted to ask, basically, what kind of storytelling does this belong in mainstream, actually, or does it belong? Because I always meet a lot of illustrators that want to go that route, but sometimes it's obviously not accepted. So, and I always think that it's probably one of the most, it's one of the best ways to get out a message and also for people to understand a story. So, yeah,
I agree with you. I feel like there are more people doing it, and I think, you know, there was a time when I was worried about, I wasn't sure what I was doing exactly, and I wasn't sure how to explain it. And it took some time for editors to sort of get on board. But now I found a lot of editors have opened up to the prospect of having comics journalism in their pages. I think they sort of grew up with comics, and once they got into those editorial positions, they're ready to look at it. So I kind of feel a lot of those barriers have gone down. You know, it does take work. The thing about comics is, as Gene knows, it's a lot of work, and you can spend years on a project. That just goes with the territory.
So I think we are about out of talking time, but we're transitioning into signing time in the auditorium lobby.
In the lobby.
Right over here. So thank you for your kind attention.
Thank you.
Aloud is made possible through support provided by the Ralph M. Parsons Foundation, the National Endowment for the Arts, and Errant Fox. Additional support provided by the Los Angeles Public Library, the Stay Home and Read a Book Ball, and individual Library Foundation members. Media support is provided by LA Weekly, KCRW 89.9 FM, and KUSC 91.5 FM.